Nothing can detect a bomb better than the nose of a working dog. And ever since 9/11, dogs are being used more and more.
What can these dogs do on the streets of America?
The very same thing that they do for our boys overseas. They detect explosives. They are a fantastic deterrent.
Mike Ritland knows about dogs. He trained some of America's finest and gave us a rare glimpse inside the secretive world of the most elite dogs.
This is a rare story. So rare that 60 Minutes has been following it for 12 years now. It's about the lost boys of Sudan and how they found their way out of a country where civil war claimed 2 million lives. Thousands were allowed to travel to America to make new homes.
I would say this is one of the most successful resettlements in U.S. history.
Wow.
Yeah, flushing's good, yeah.
They'd come to a new world in every possible sense of the word. They'd never even imagined things that are part of our lives.
Wonderful machine.
The story of survival and hope, tonight on 60 Minutes.
I'm Steve Croft.
I'm Leslie Stahl.
I'm Morley Safer.
I'm Bob Simon.
I'm Laura Logan.
I'm Scott Pelley. Those stories tonight on 60 Minutes.
When the bombs went off at the Boston Marathon this spring, highly trained dogs were rushed to the scene to search for more explosives. Boston police said dogs swept the streets in the morning and a second time just an hour before the first marathoners crossed the finish line. It's now known that the bombers planted their devices well after the dogs finished sweeping the area. Since 9/11, dogs have been used more than ever because nothing has proven more effective against hidden bombs than the nose of a working dog. The best of them serve with U.S. Special Operations, and they're in a league of their own. It's nearly impossible to get anyone to talk about them publicly because much of what they do is classified. But we were able to talk to the people who train them for this story. And as we first reported in April, we took the opportunity to ask about what happened in Boston while getting a rare glimpse inside the secretive world of America's most elite dogs. Green Beret Chris Corbin and his dog Axe are at 14,000 feet in the skies over North Carolina. They're about to test a new harness that America's best soldiers will use to jump into combat. But it's not for Corbin, it's for Axe. As they freefall for nearly 10,000 feet at 125 miles an hour, Axe is wrapped in Corbin's arms. They've been to war together, nearly died together, and they never like to be too far apart.
Do you think he enjoyed it?
He just wants to do whatever I'm doing. He doesn't care what it is.
You've said that these dogs feel like they're invincible.
Absolutely.
What makes you say that?
We don't train them to fail.
Sergeant First Class Corbin is a dog handler with 7th Special Forces Group.
Axie.
And he and 6-year-old Axe have been a team for 3 years.
Yes, sir.
They deployed to Helmand in southern Afghanistan at a time when more Americans were dying there than any other place in the country. Corbin and Axe's job was to lead their unit through a battlefield littered with hidden bombs.
We walked in front. We cleared the pass for everyone to move through.
You say it so easily, I walked out front, like it's nothing. But what does that actually mean when you're the one walking out front?
You're the one risking, I hate to say the most, but yeah, you're out front. I'm the one who makes it safe or announces it is safe for everyone else to walk behind.
What's your level of trust in your dog?
It has to be just perfect trust.
Perfect trust that begins with trainers like former Navy SEAL Mike Ritland. He's one of just a handful of people in this country who finds and trains these dogs for special operations and top-tier units in the FBI and police departments across the U.S.
What can these dogs do on the streets of America?
the very same thing that they do for our boys overseas, in that they detect explosives. They are a fantastic deterrent. They use their nose to find, you know, people as well.
Would an average police dog have found these bombs at the Boston Marathon if they'd already been placed on the ground, you know, before they were sweeping through there?
There's a lot of variables that I'm not aware of as to where they were and what was done in terms of the sweeps, but based on what I do know, yes, if dogs went through the areas where they were placed, you know, your average certified police bomb dog should have found them. My thoughts are if these guys are paying close attention to these dogs, they're waiting. And when the dogs leave, they bring it in, they infiltrate essentially, they drop it right where it's busy, and very soon after it detonates.
Mike Ritland knows from his own experience on the ground in Iraq what it means to have one of these elite dogs on your team.
When you step outside that wire...
Like outside the base.
Outside the base, it's crossing the border to hell on earth. Every step you take is that same feeling of the very next step that I take may be my last. When you see these dogs operate in the capacity that they can, using their nose and finding explosives in the manner that they do, that level of comfort absolutely skyrockets in your mind, because you know that you've got one of the best trained, best equipped, best capable, you know, working dogs out in front of you that has your back.
We met Mike Ritland on his 20-acre ranch in rural Cooper, Texas, where he runs his own company.
Tell me some of the things that these dogs can actually do. I mean, they jump out of planes, helicopters.
You can free fall with them. You can rappel with them. You can fast rope with them. You can swim with them. I mean, they can ride on boats. They can ride on your back. There's not really an environment that we operate in that you can't bring a dog.
There's such a demand for them that Mike Ritland says they'd be used on almost every mission if there were enough of them. And it's not just about their nose. Ritland is training this dog, Rico, to track humans and take down enemy fighters. He's 3.5 years old, and Ritland has been working with him for the past year.
Stop!
Look at him go. Oh my gosh, he's fast.
Here, he's about to apprehend a suspect. These dogs can run faster than 30 miles an hour. The suspect is one of Mike Ritland's partners, and he's screaming to make this as realistic as possible. These dogs are trained to capture, not to kill.
There's no human being on earth that can outrun them. You know, I can tell you that the physical capability of these dogs is impossible to explain and even hard to comprehend when you see it.
How hard can they bite?
Hard enough to break bones. I had a dog bite me right here like this. He only had his mouth on me for probably 4 or 5 seconds and broke my wrist.
Broke your wrist in 4 or 5 seconds?
Just broke it.
Mike Ritland says they have to teach these dogs how to deal with someone who wants to harm them. The trainer is putting pressure on him without hurting him. The aim is to make the dog comfortable, then teach him to ignore it. And by the end, Ritland says, the dog won't let it affect him at all.
The number one thing that I look for in a dog is that dog, when pushed and when he's put into an uncomfortable spot where physically and mentally he's got pressure on him, and I give him the choice, and it's absolutely a choice, to either stay and fight me or to quit and run, that dog decides, I'm going to stay and fight you and I'm going to beat you. When you do find that, it is a unicorn in that they almost don't exist.
Arco is one of those rare dogs. He's retired after repeated deployments to Iraq and Afghanistan, and he now lives on Mike Ritland's ranch. Most of what he's done is classified, so Ritland could only tell us a little about the operation that almost killed him when he took down an enemy fighter who shot him in the chest.
And he maintained control of the guy, you know, after being shot. So
at point blank range.
Mm-hmm. Yep. So, you know, it's funny because a lot of people, you know, I think scoff at the idea that, you know, what kind of obstacles can these dogs really go through? you know, and it's more than most humans.
For a dog to make it in the world of special operations, Mike Ritlin says there are certain qualities that have to be there from the beginning.
He's already, you know, displaying the prey drive and possessiveness that we like to see, and then he'll put uncomfortable objects in his mouth.
Most of the dogs that do this work well are from one breed, Belgian Malinois. And there are only three places in the U.S. that breed them for top-tier military units, like this one in West Virginia, where Mike Ritlin gets some of his dogs.
No, they're so cute.
Here they specialize in the early stages of training, which starts almost from birth, with loud noises that are meant to get them used to the sounds they may one day face in combat. Their noses are up to 1,000 times more sensitive than a human's, and at just a few months old, they start learning to ignore other smells and distractions while zeroing in on the scent of a bomb.
So here she's trying to get him to be disobedient to that odor, and he won't do it.
They'll repeat this training over and over for 2 years, so that by the time this dog goes to war or is needed on America's streets, nothing will take it off the track of a bomb.
Everybody knows that dogs can smell better than humans, but what they don't realize is that if you and I walk into the kitchen and there's a pot of beef stew on the counter, you and I smell beef stew. A dog smells potatoes, carrots, beef, onion, celery, gravy, flour. They smell each and every individual component of everything that's in that beef stew, and they can separate every one of those. You can't hide anything from them. It won't work because you can't fool a dog's nose.
Dogs and their handlers work as a team, and they go through so much together, their bond is as strong as a band of brothers. Green Beret Chris Corbin and Axe almost died together in Afghanistan on their final mission. Corbin says everything was going right that day, and Axe had already found one bomb. They moved together to an area that had been cleared, and that's when he says he missed Axe's signal.
All of a sudden, he wasn't pulling forward, he was pulling down. I was, what are you doing, buddy? Hold still. I wasn't thinking it. Maybe he's sniffing my foot, maybe I passed by a dog, all these other things why he would be looking down. And I looked down, and he was just intently sniffing all around my foot, and it started to occur to me that, okay,
Wait a minute.
You know, while I was coming out of the building, we're already in a place that we know is full of mines, why is he sniffing down my foot? And at that moment, it was just that too little too late. And that was it.
Axe was shaken up by the blast, but not wounded. Chris Corbin lost both his lower legs. Yet in less than 5 months, he was back on active duty as a Green Beret. He says Axe had a lot to do with it and described the moment he saw him again for the first time.
They brought him up for a visit, and I heard him getting him out of the back of the truck and opening his kennel, and he was just being stir crazy dog, just, hey, let me out of here, let's go look around. I just said something simple, hey, where's my boy at? And he stopped, he froze, he looked around, and he went into a panic until he found me, and he jumped on my legs. Painful. I was just happy to see him. I didn't care how much it hurt.
During our entire interview, Axe never left Corbin's side and barely took his eyes off him. Corbin says he's fearless because he doesn't know when he's in danger.
Some people might say, well, that's unfair to the dog because you're sending this dog into a dangerous environment where he could very easily lose his life or limbs, be wounded, and he doesn't understand.
I could make him scared of it and make him not do his job and send soldiers to the same death. That's my answer to that.
It wasn't until after 9/11 that special operations formally began using dogs, starting in Afghanistan. Dwayne Khan and his dog Rex survived a tough deployment there in 2010.
I saw my dog, you know, try to smash through doors, climb up cliffs, drag people down cliffs, just track people, find odors that were hidden up in a ceiling, just you name it. It seemed like every day I was being amazed by these dogs.
Karn has been a covert operator for 21 years. He told us these dogs are so effective, they're now being targeted. A Taliban commander told a member of our team that on his last operation, they were ordered to open fire on the American dogs first and deal with the soldiers next.
God damn it!
In Afghanistan, there have been 42 dogs killed in action. And when they're wounded in combat, they get the same care as any soldier. And when these dogs retire from special operations, some of them, like Rex, Dwayne Khan's dog, find jobs with law enforcement. He's now working with the San Diego Sheriff's Department. Those who can't work anymore often end up with Mike Ritland, who started the Warrior Dog Foundation to look after them. Ritland is the first person to write a book about these elite dogs. He says when budgets are being cut, he hopes people won't forget how much a well-trained dog like Rico means on today's battlefield and on our city streets.
And he's your dog?
Right now he is, yep. It's always subject to change, but, you know, he's better serving our country than he is being my personal dog. So, you know, when the time comes for him to answer that call, I'm always happy to see them go do something for the greater good.
Go to 60MinutesOvertime.com to see one of our producers try to outrun an elite dog of war.
Twelve years ago, 60 Minutes aired a story about lost boys from Sudan who fought off unspeakable dangers and then flew off to the United States. It all began in the 1980s during Sudan's civil war in which more than 2 million people died. The boys' parents were killed, their sisters often sold into slavery. Many of the boys died too, but the survivors, thousands of them, started walking across East Africa alone. 5 years later, they walked into a refugee camp in Kenya. That's where we first met them, when many were hoping to go to the United States. Well, 3,000 did, as part of the largest resettlement of its kind in American history. We followed the boys for more than a decade and couldn't resist revisiting them to see how they're doing. But first, we'll take you back to northern Kenya, to the Kakuma refugee camp, springtime 2001. Nothing drew a crowd like the list. Once a week, the lost boys saw their destiny on a bulletin board, the staples of life. On this day, 90 learned they'd be going to America.
Boston.
I'm going to Florida.
Florida?
Florida.
Every Sunday, a plane arrived at the camp to take the boys from nowhere to somewhere. From Kakuma to JFK and beyond. Not all of the lost boys got to go. Joseph Taban Rufino had walked to the board so many times he tried not to get excited.
What's new?
Something new.
What?
Yeah, I've seen my name on the board.
Your name's on the board, huh?
Yeah.
Where are you going?
This is Kansas City.
Kansas City?
Yeah.
Do you know where it is?
I don't know.
Abraham Yelniel was taking this walk for the 25th time. He was an ordained minister of Sudan's Episcopal Church at Kakuma. He looked at the board as if it were a holy scroll.
I'm going to Chicago. Is it interesting?
Oh, it's very interesting. It's very interesting. Yeah.
Thank you for that.
They were called the Lost Boys because they were between 5 and 11 when their Christian villages in southern Sudan were attacked by Islamist forces from the north. When they saw their villages burning, they started running. Streams of boys became rivers. Hundreds became thousands until an exodus of biblical proportions was underway. They walked for 3 months across Sudan, barefoot. 12,000 found refuge in Ethiopia. But after 4 years, they were chased out at gunpoint, chased to the Gilo River, where the waters did not part. For Joseph Taban, that day will never go away.
We saw so many people who were just floating on the river.
Dead bodies.
Dead bodies, yeah. Were floating on the river.
Many were shot, many drowned, many were eaten by crocodiles. Zachariah Magak was there.
1,000 to 2,000 were died in that river.
1,000 or 2,000 died in that river.
Yes.
It wasn't much better on the other side. They walked across deserts, over mountains. They had no food or water. Paul Dang was 7 when he started the walk.
You have to urinate so that you drink your own urine.
Did you ever do it yourself?
Yeah, I didn't want to die. Other people didn't want to die.
In the spring of 1992, after walking more than 1,000 miles, the boys made it over the border into Kenya to a desolate place called Kakuma. For the UN, it was an emergency of vast proportions, these emaciated children. For the boys, it was the safest they'd been in 5 years. Joseph became a medical assistant at the camp clinic. Abraham found a job preaching the gospel in a church built of mud. The Lost Boys couldn't go home to Sudan, and Kenya didn't want them. Then, in the year 2000, the State Department decided they deserved a break and invited them to come live in the United States.
What we want to do is give you a correct understanding of what life will be like in America.
Before they took off for their new lives in the new world, Sasha Chanoff, a teacher from Boston, gave them a crash course, America 101.
Does anybody know who the president of the U.S. is now?
George Bush W.
Things they could not imagine, like winter.
This is a little what winter in America feels like. What does it feel like?
It's very cold.
Will you die because of that coolness?
No, people do not die because of the coolness.
He had 3 days to prepare them for a leap of 1,000 years.
Many of them have never been exposed to lights or to a fork and a knife or seen a TV. It's a group that's lost in time.
They had 4 days to pack their luggage. They took little, left less behind. Abraham was taking a book he'd been carrying for 10 years.
You still have the Bible that you carried from Ethiopia here?
Yes. It's my life. I've been called a lost boy, but I'm not lost from God. I lost from my parents.
As in any farewell, the lost boys were saying, see you soon. But they knew better. Kakuma was losing its doctor and its priest.
Take it together and put it in.
The boys had never been on a plane before. They'd never even been on a bus.
Good.
Five planes in 2 days. First initiation rite, airplane food. And then changing planes in Brussels, getting their feet on the ground in the Western world. Next stop for Joseph Taban and his brothers, Kansas City.
There it is.
Oh, yeah.
You see the buildings?
Yeah, yeah.
That is Kansas City.
I see. I didn't know that this place is so big like this.
Abraham, the preacher man, was supposed to go to Chicago, but at the last minute, that was changed to Atlanta. Volunteers introduced them to the new apartments, to American mysteries, like a sink or a stove.
Don't touch, because it burns.
It's hot.
A vacuum cleaner. Or a can, let alone a can opener.
You want to try?
Wonderful machine.
Within a few weeks, Joseph had his first job in a sweltering fabric factory. When he got home from work at 11 at night, he stayed up studying for that medical career he'd always dreamed of. You won't be surprised to learn that Abraham found his salvation in church. All Saints, one of the largest Episcopal churches in Atlanta. A month after his arrival, he was invited to be a guest deacon.
Hallelujah, hallelujah.
Thanks be to God. Hallelujah, hallelujah.
You were terrific, Abraham.
Yes.
You were so good.
The big problem was the sheer size of America and everything in it. Home Depot was a long way from home.
This store is too big.
Oh, I know it is.
This is confusing.
Confusing? Try to imagine what a fountain looks like to a man who's walked 1,000 miles through a desert. Sasha Chanoff, who taught the boys back in Kenya, said it was not easy for them to distinguish between what was real and what was pure fantasy in America.
They're hearing the people have gone to the moon. If you're telling me people have gone to the moon, then they're seeing on TV that a horse can talk. Why is a horse talking so different from someone going to the moon? It's hard for people to distinguish what is reality and what is not. Some boys saw a street sign that said dead end, and they thought, well, if I go down there, am I going to die?
Then came 9/11, just a few months after the boys got here. They thought they'd left that kind of thing far behind forever.
And it seemed that war is following us. Wherever we go, war came up to us.
Let's pray.
As it did once again. The boys weren't surprised by it, not the way Americans were. For them, Islam and terrorism went together, always had. Their reaction was immediate. Help the victims. In Atlanta, they offered to donate blood for the survivors in New York, but they were turned away.
So what we did, we just collect some money, $2, $5, because we have nothing. And we give about $400.
$400?
Yes. And that is amazing.
It really is.
Yes. A community with nothing. People just came from Africa.
But they weren't coming anymore. After 9/11, the flight scheduled to bring over more lost boys were stopped. And the boys already here were having a tough time of it. That dreaded American winter was now upon them. They'd been warned, but it still came as a shock.
Look, 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 look.
Winter gave them fun times as well, though. Ice capades. What Americans call a learning experience. And Christmas, their first.
In America, we call him Santa Claus.
Okay, Santa Claus. I do hear of Santa Claus. Uh-huh.
He lives up in the North Pole with me. He rides on reindeer.
Okay. Mm-hmm. You mean he lives in North Pole?
Yeah.
Is he from, how do I call these people?
Eskimos.
Eskimos, yeah? Eskimos.
Well, he's the guy who brings presents to all the children on Christmas.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
He makes kids happy. That's the important thing.
That's good. That's good. Yeah.
Okay, pull back.
Within a year, a Kansas City investment banker, Joey McCliney, took Joseph under his wing and put him in the saddle.
Whoa now. Only use that leg.
McCliney offered up his brand new car for Joseph's first driving lesson.
There you go. Okay. Stop, okay. Joseph. Stop. Brake.
Oh, what?
Brake. Okay, don't let go. Let go, Joseph. Hit the brake.
Okay. Isn't it?
That's the brake, the big one. Okay.
Oh, what?
Relax.
I'm so sorry what
That's
I made.
All right.
Yeah?
Relax.
Okay. I'm sorry, I made a mistake. Yeah.
That was nearly 12 years ago. In a moment, we'll give you a picture of the road the Lost Boys have been taking in America. Before their arrival in America in 2001, the Lost Boys of Sudan knew very little about what would be a totally new world for them. For the U.S. government, it was quite a social experiment. America may be a country of immigrants, but it's not often that the State Department organizes an airlift of people who know virtually nothing about the modern world. The Lost Boys were sent all over the place, from Fargo, North Dakota, to Phoenix, Arizona. Joseph Taban Rufino landed in Kansas City. Abraham Yelniel was sent to Atlanta. We never forgot about them and their fellow Lost Boys, and as we reported last spring, we felt good when it appeared they hadn't forgotten about us.
Hey, Simon! How you doing? Long time no see.
Hey.
How you doing, buddy?
How are you doing, man?
been a long time.
We visited the Lost Boys from time to time over the last 12 years. Wanted to be there for the moments they never could have imagined.
I hereby declare...
I hereby declare...
On this day, Abraham was one of 92 people from 37 countries to get a new piece of paper.
Congratulations, you're a United States citizen.
Thank you, madam.
A lost boy who now belongs somewhere.
Do you think of yourself as an American?
Yes. This home for me.
Abraham is so proud of his American passport, he carries it with him wherever he goes.
The only papers we have are from America.
Are you telling me that that passport in that jacket pocket of yours is the first identity paper you've ever had?
This it.
Before that, you had no document at all?
No.
Joseph still hasn't gotten a passport. His driver's license was stolen from him in Kansas City, and that was just the beginning.
You've had your car flooded.
Right.
You've been stabbed.
Exactly.
You've been hit by a car.
That's right.
Your kitchen was set on fire.
Indeed.
And you like it here?
Things happen.
There was more bad news at work. Joseph was laid off a few times from his job at a grain company, the victim of the tough economy. He's back at work now, and in his small, dimly lit apartment, still studies medical books, even while his dream of going to med school is slipping away.
Do you feel like you've been successful in America?
Not at all. My main aim was to go to the school in order to mean to be what I've said, to be a doctor. But things fall apart.
So unless you're a doctor, you will not feel that you are successful.
That's true.
Abraham did graduate from college.
It's been a long journey, but God bless me.
After many 4 a.m. bus rides to school, he got a degree in biblical studies from Atlanta Christian College.
Congratulations.
So how did you make those roofs?
Sasha Chanoff, who led those orientation classes back at Kakuma, now runs an organization called Refuge Point, which champions refugees in Africa. He still stays in touch with the Lost Boys.
I would say this is one of the most successful resettlements in U.S. history.
Wow.
Some of them are in law school, some are in medical school. But of course, when you have 4,000 guys or so who arrive, some don't do as well. Some struggle.
Some have had problems with drugs and alcohol. A few are in jail. But some lost boys who were orphaned by war have been wounded fighting for the U.S. military in Iraq and Afghanistan. Dar Dakhan made it out unscathed.
So you were in Iraq
three times? Yes.
He joined the army after 9/11.
I'm a young man able to hold a gun or to go with the other young men in this country who were born here. Why not? That's my duty.
So you joined the army because you wanted to give something back to America?
Yes.
Thank you, America. I want to let the whole world know.
Dominic Leake, a friend of Joseph's in Kansas City, wrote a song he says represents the feelings of many lost boys.
When I came to this country, I was helped by the government of this country and the people of America. So what I did was I thanked them for the opportunity they gave to me and my fellow lost boy.
We were forced into the river.
Abraham feels he has a mission to make sure people will not forget. He speaks at universities across the country. Here he was at Yale, explaining to students why he believes God kept the boys alive.
God kept us alive to be witness of what took place in Sudan. That's the only thing. It's not because we were more important than others, than our mother, than father, than brothers of died, but simply so that we will be witness.
It happened a long time ago, so the lost boys don't have too much trouble talking about it. But at nighttime...
Do you have a lot of nightmares?
Oh, indeed, a lot. During the young age, where we were when I was there, we're not supposed to see the dead body or bury the dead body. And we did that. And that's all comes like sometimes in form of dream.
For the Lost Boys, the most momentous news came in July of 2011. Their long-suffering homeland, South Sudan, was declared the world's newest nation.
You saw the independence celebrations on your cell phone?
Yeah.
How did it make you feel?
Oh, I was overwhelmed, going into tears.
They were an important factor that led to that independence.
Hang on. They were an important factor that led to the independence?
I think so. They created a political environment in the U.S. where people were finally realizing what was happening in this remote genocide in Sudan that nobody had really heard of on a large scale before.
Not long ago, Sudanese flocked by the hundreds to a town called Awil for a celebration. It wasn't Independence Day or anything like that. They came to a newly built brick cathedral to witness the installation of that preacher named Abraham as the first Episcopal bishop of his region in South Sudan.
Accepted and invested.
Accepted and invested.
And now to be inducted.
And now to be inducted.
A lost boy no more. It's Bishop Abraham now. And who knows what's coming next.
Maybe your next name will be Archbishop.
I don't know about that.
Abraham divides his time now between Africa and America. Not only is he an Anglican bishop, but a husband and a father.
Oh, my heavens. This is your family?
Yes.
He goes back to Africa whenever he can to visit his new family. He got married in Kenya, has four kids. He wants them to join him in Atlanta, but red tape keeps getting in the way.
Well, I would love that to happen, Bob. I've been tried for them to come, but did not come. Maybe one day somebody will surprise me that you and your kid come to America.
Joseph hasn't gone back to Africa, has had no reason to. His whole family was dead as far as he knew. Then, incredible news, his mother Perina was alive, had survived the war, had made it to a refugee camp in Uganda. And there was another miracle. Skype. So a few months ago, Joseph ironed his best suit and went over to his mentor's house. His mother had been driven 3 hours to the offices of IOM, the International Resettlement Agency in South Sudan. It was the first time mother and son were going to see each other since they were separated by war 25 years ago.
Hello.
Hello.
Baba.
You missed.
Mom.
Angai.
Mom.
Mom.
Hello.
Angai.
Mom. Ateri.
Kuma, you missed.
Walai. Ombu gunabe. Hello.
His mother had thought Joseph was dead, had held a funeral service for him. Even now, she had no idea what he'd been through.
Ethiopia, okay?
When Joseph tried to tell her, he just couldn't get through it. But there were light moments, too. Shared memories of Joseph's happy childhood in a country village. Before the war ended childhood and everything else. And of course, his mother wanted to know why, after all these years, Joseph had not married a nice American girl. After almost an hour, their time was almost up. His mother asked Joseph what all mothers ask their sons, "When will you come see me?" And Joseph answered the only possible answer.
Okay?
As soon as I can, Mom. As soon as I can.
Come on, you miss. Come on.
After we first aired Joseph's video reunion with his mom last spring, 60 Minutes viewers donated enough money for Joseph to fly to South Sudan to see his mom in person. Once Joseph gets his travel documents, that reunion is expected to happen in the coming months. Now an update on a story we first reported last year called Joy in the Congo. That's when we visited one of the most extraordinary musical ensembles we've ever seen. The Kimbanga Symphony Orchestra of Kinshasa, the capital city of one of the poorest countries in the world. Maestro Armand Yengyenda, a former pilot, began the orchestra with neither teachers, instruments, musicians, nor anyone who could read music. But miraculously, they played. This past March, members of the Kimbangist Orchestra left their usual home, a rented warehouse in Kinshasa, for Los Angeles and the Walt Disney Concert Hall. There, the string ensemble performed an original composition for the LA Philharmonic's conductor, Gustavo Dudamel.
You sound great. Sounds great, wonderful. I want to listen more.
Congo, our original report on the Kimbangist Symphony, was named a winner of the Peabody Award. I'm Bob Simon. We'll be back next week with another edition of 60 Minutes.